So we have part two of this Lumpur Liam talk, given in 1991. We're a little bit more than halfway through the talk. During this phase of practice, another change occurred. This change, speaking in proper scholarly terms, might be described as the experience vipassanupakilesa, experiences which defile insight. I had a feeling of bliss and bright radiance within myself, lasting days and nights. Not many of us have that problem. The bright light is not like the light of the sun or any source of light, but it is something you feel inside that has these radiant qualities. I didn't get carried away with thinking that it was something special. I merely saw what happened as an experience within the practice, happening in and of itself. Things like this can happen. So for my part, I determined to be mindful and not get lost identifying myself with being this or that. If one harbors these feelings of self-importance, one is almost sure to go crazy from such an experience. This is what happens to some practitioners at this stage. They start feeling special and superior to others, seeing everybody else as inferior to themselves, for example. These feelings can occur, so I was determined to have mindfulness and awareness, and not let myself get involved with feelings of wanting and giving things personal importance, constantly telling myself, experiences like this, having arisen, must cease again. I had mindfulness with regard to this and focused in this way on what I was experiencing day and night. These experiences can happen. The Buddha even gave them a name, defilements of insight, vipassanupakilesa. They all occur within the scope of vipassana. It seems like when one enters the realm of vipassana, one has to also enter the realm of vipassana upakilesa. That's the way things happen. But I didn't get lost or deluded. I didn't get carried away with myself. All I saw was a situation of arising, existence, and change. I still kept up all the daily routines. Most of the time, when I sat down meditating, I didn't sit all that long. During this phase, I sat for only a bit more than an hour. This seemed to be conducive for my body, and I never had any physical problems. No pain or other frustrating symptoms. Not having health issues, one can practice with ease. I did not develop feelings of self-importance regarding the things that arose in my practice. I kept doing the communal chores, keeping to myself while doing the work, looking at my own mind, my own feelings, just the same as before. I was consciously aware of myself, observing and trying to watch myself not only when I was awake, but also when sleeping. As I was practicing with unremitting effort, yet another change came. I reached a low and dark spot, feeling that I was under attack again. Sexual desires would flare up every now and again. Other than watching these symptoms suddenly come up, I didn't have any tools to add to my practice. These feelings were displaying themselves, but I didn't develop worries and concerns because of them. I simply stayed alert and was very careful. Whatever happened, one had to be careful, to be on the watch and always suspicious, just as though one were watching wild animals. One sits quietly and composed, as wild animals constantly run back and forth. I was always on the watch, not trusting the situation in a way that kept me wide awake and well aware. Physically, this was actually quite tiring at times. I felt exhausted and weak. It was like constantly being in a state where there is no room for relaxation, but I kept doing the practice. Then, on one of those days, things changed again. They were perpetually changing anyway. Certain questions came up in my mind. The question arose, this practice, what do we do it for? I was stunned when the answer came, as if the silence itself was answering. This practice? No need to ask. We practice for the sake of practice. This is the way the answer came up. These words appeared expressing something in a certain form, and there was nothing more to it. The answer was there. That was all. The problem was gone. When I got up in the morning, I continued doing my personal chores and routines. I never abandoned the communal work and tried to maintain my personal routine. When a new day came, I did my job. But then another change happened, an experience of a new kind that I didn't anticipate. Something happened that made me feel very energized. My mind felt strong. The body was light. When I walked, it felt as if I wasn't walking. When I sat, it felt as if I wasn't sitting. The body felt indescribably light. Again, I didn't see this as something special. Probably it wasn't. If I were to pin down the experience in scholarly terms, it may not have been anything beyond experiencing the qualities of pitti. In fact, the Buddha speaks about many types in which pitti can manifest. So I didn't feel concerned about what was happening. I didn't feel I had to analyze it. I simply did what I did, thinking merely that this was what was happening in my experience. One can say it is like this. In whatever situation one may have a certain feeling, by the next day it will have changed. And in fact, the next day things did change again. There were many changes. Both happiness and suffering were alternating chaotically. And the experience of some happiness here and some suffering there, I didn't know what this happiness and suffering meant. To say that it had a definite cause wouldn't hold up. What it was simply feelings at work. On that day, I was doing walking meditation, just like I used to do every day. The evening came and the sun set, and the sound of the cicadas announced the coming darkness. I had no torch or anything, only matches and candles for some light at night. In my kuti, there wasn't much apart from my inner and outer robe, my bowl, and a bathing cloth. That's about all, except for maybe two or three candles, if I wanted to do some walking meditation or had any other urgent reason for using light. I decided to sit and walk meditation, practicing samadhi in the same way I had done it every day. I sat in order to relax a little before going to sleep and felt I was continually observing and watching. On that day, I was physically quite tired and exhausted. My limbs felt painful, and my feet felt as if they were bruised. So I took the opportunity to rest a little in meditation, giving my mind a break. I sat in equanimity, and that was it. I sat not experiencing anything at all, exactly like someone who had no thoughts, only the experience of sitting with nothing, with no thoughts at all, exclusively possessed of consciousness. The body felt very light, light in the body, light in the mind. Whatever happened felt like being in a certain state of experience. I wouldn't even call it good. It was simply something that was happening. It felt very cool and soothing within the body. It felt like my brain, or to put it in better words, my head, was cool. The experience was one of feeling completely empty, cooled down, and light. It lasted all day and all night, whether I was standing, walking, sitting, or lying down. In fact, I was completely indifferent towards the various feelings that I had been subject to all the time before, since long, long ago. Aversion, anger, love, for example, having all kinds of fantasies and proliferations, seeing things either positively or negatively, didn't exist. I was in the state of equanimity. There was no experience of any expressions of liking or disliking. To say that things were good or bad, I wouldn't say that. I can only say that this is an experience of how one feels without classifying it as good or bad. The conditioned phenomena of the physical body are recognized as merely phenomena of the material world, rupa dhamma, that eventually have to arrive at the point where they disintegrate and dissolve. The thinking mind, or what we call sankhara, or mental proliferations, doesn't manifest at all. There is only the faculty of seeing things in accordance with the truth. Anything which manifests appears the way it really is. Viewing things in line with truth means the end of problems. This experience has lasted continuously. Since that day, I haven't seen feelings of happiness or suffering occur, or any symptoms of aversion coming up. There is the experience of being in one's own natural state, living lightly and silently, at ease in one's own mind. This is how it is, without having to force it to be that way. I didn't force anything. It is an experience in and of itself. I understand that this arose and became manifest due to the practice. but I don't consider myself as good or superior or being somehow special. I see this as a mode in which the qualities of the Dhamma become evident as a result of one's actions, leaving everything up to its original cause. One understands physical manifestations, the Rupa Khanda, in terms of what actually happens, that is, arising in the beginning, change in the middle, and disintegration in the end. I see my own form and that of other people as beings in this way. I understand that seeing things in this way means having the view of Dhamma. When seeing things as Dhamma in this way, there aren't any proliferations. There is no activity of sankhara or worldly objects of the mind that arise. I understand this as truth, correctness, or an expression of the tranquility and seclusion of my own experience. But I don't attach or identify with this state in any way either. This is just what I have been doing in my practice. This experience continues to this moment. It manifests as a feeling of being grounded in knowing, or an experience of living in the Dhamma, nothing else. The experience of feeling cool and tranquil in the body was ongoing for 2 or 3 years. It was something that happened by itself. I hadn't been anticipating it and wasn't making anything more out of it. I upheld that I might as well leave these kinds of things up to their karmic flow. Thinking in this way, wherever things go, one can let them follow the stream of how things feel in themselves. No need to interfere with planning, arranging, or seeking all kinds of things. Things unfold in their own way, and one should consider any fruits that arise as the result of these processes in and of themselves. If the resulting karma is to be of use to the world, it necessarily needs to be the fruit of wholesome action. This is what I uphold, although I am not thinking too much about it. Should there be a cause for one to change locations, one still keeps the way one feels grounded in its original state and does not develop strong reactions. Practice not to force anything whatsoever by yourself, but act in accordance with the Dhamma. That means not allowing biases and prejudices to arise and affect you. Keep to the principle of always watching yourself. See whether prejudices are developing, and look at others and the society around you in a completely unbiased way, seeing things with equanimity, acting with equanimity, not expressing feelings of liking or disliking. This will give rise to feelings and experiences that are very supportive to living in the Dhamma. This indeed is something very good. From this time on, I haven't spent much time thinking about practice. I just live from day to day. Whenever Longpo Cha told me to go to some other place, I went because I wanted to give something back to him out of gratitude. He had supported me, and I wanted to repay him to the best of my capabilities. As long as the karmic situation I was experiencing would allow, I wanted to do my part. After the rains retreat of 1969, he didn't send me anywhere. I simply stayed here until the time came when he recruited all the monks and novices to go to Wat Tham Sang Pet. Recruiting is actually the right word. Lungpo said he would open up the opportunity for anyone who had some strength to go and help building up this new place for practice. When he himself went for a month or two, I also took the opportunity to go and help. After this occasion, Lungpo had me go to various other places, and I always followed his wish. I didn't go anywhere because of my own ideas, so I never faced any problems. I wouldn't have known anyway what would have been helpful for the Sangha or of benefit to Buddhism on the larger scale, so I followed his advice. In 1970, he sent me to Wat Srathong in Laos, together with a monk from Laos, another Thai monk, and a samanera from Songkhla. Two of them have since disrobed. It was good being in Laos. In addition to helping to organize and look after the monastery buildings and making repairs, I also taught the laypeople. At the end of the next rainy season, I received a letter from Lungpo asking me to return, but there was no immediate opportunity. I wasn't able to go straight away. A little while later, I was able to return. After that, Lungpo Cha didn't send me anywhere, so I have stayed at Wat Nongpapong ever since. So I have been helping Lungpo, but in fact, I wasn't really helping him all that much. All I did was keep the standard monastery routines, the kol wat. That's all. Nowadays, my physical condition has gotten to the point of being quite old, so I sometimes choose to quietly withdraw. Most of the time, I will not join in with the other monks to lead the chanting or to perform other such activities. I understand that this kind of routine must depend on each monk's own individual effort. Of course, I could still sit with you, but these days I feel that this would prevent you from becoming more self-reliant. Many times the attitude develops, if the teacher doesn't do these things, we won't do them either. But you should really ask yourself, why should we stop doing the practice just because the teacher isn't around? Lungpo Cha himself actually didn't lead the meditation all that often. Sometimes he did, but not always. Of course, it is good in one way to rely on a teacher and to let him guide you, but in another sense, it isn't good. To practice like this merely relies on faith and a sense of being afraid of the teacher. This, however, is not the kind of faith that supports one in being able to depend on one's own barami. One should rather incline one's practice towards developing the kind of faith that supports one's own self-reliance. This is done by observing one's monastic duties, the kichawata, and by doing them consistently, regardless of the difficulties that may come up. Whether there are difficulties actually depends on our strength. When we aren't strong, there are a lot of problems. But with increasing strength, problems diminish. One can see, for example, that in the periods where we have strong faith and are pleased with our practice, the hindrances aren't a problem and there are no obstacles. But whenever our faith faculty is weak, it is like everything is twice as difficult. It feels like we don't have anything to fall back on for help. In this practice, we really need to train by ourselves. If we are going to rely on the teacher, we should do this by taking on his methods and standards. We should take these standards and equip ourselves with them, making them our own regular practices. Here we are not talking about much more than simply observing the daily schedule and routines. But in our attitude towards these things, we need to maintain our mindfulness. Hold on to being mindful as a principle. Yet our faculty of memory, sannya, is such that it may occur that we sometimes are forgetful or deluded about things. That's fine. Let's allow this to happen and yet keep our awareness perfectly ready to be fully alert. I would say, if we can keep our alertness in this way, what we experience is what is called patibbana, ready wit, one of the facets of insight. That can be an excellent refuge for us, even if only to the level of allowing us to be able to question things for ourselves. Question those proliferations that arise and deceive us, appearing to be a problem. Just like when somebody approaches us in a threatening way, we can face him and ask him to reveal his intentions. With mindfulness and alertness, we are able to question ourselves and inquire about the things that arise. If one can inquire about things, one can also stop them. That's the way it is. When problems arise, let them give you the answer by themselves. Revert to peace and tranquility, and things will speak for themselves. If a problem has arisen, it can also be solved. When obstacles come up, they can be overcome. This is the way to approach things. The solutions are there. It is not that there are no solutions. Just like in the saying of the Buddha, whenever there is darkness, light also has to exist. We have to look at things in this way. If no light existed at all, the Buddha would not have taught. If it was the case that no one could manage to do these things, the Buddha would not have made the effort to teach and guide people. Those people that are not good, he teaches to be good. Those people that do not know, he teaches to know. Please understand it this way. Don't just wait and be totally dependent on others. That's not the way. One has to rely on oneself. Train yourself to be self-reliant. Whatever concerns other people, let it be their problem. Whatever concerns one's physical condition, let it be just that. We try not to object to our physical limitations. If the body is weak or it shows signs of deterioration, then we see this as natural. We know the way the body is and react appropriately. We adapt and train ourselves to and keep making adjustments. But we should always maintain knowledge and understanding, really knowing, developing this all the way until true knowledge arises, as is referred to with the word Buddha or Butto, the one who knows, the awakened one, the blissful one. Then, eventually, all the various problems will disappear. No suffering or drawbacks of any kind. All that is left is freedom. One experiences the freedom of being one's own sole refuge. The body, however, still relies on external conditions. No absolute freedom in this sense exists. The body still depends on nature. It still depends on certain conditions for support according to its age. One needs to see this independently. Not seeing the physical condition independently means not to have understood it yet. Our experience needs to differentiate these aspects. Everything else depends on how our spiritual potential, our barami, unfolds, on how much energy we have. If our spiritual powers have matured and reached a certain level of completion, they will find ways of erupting, breaking loose, and manifesting by themselves. It is like an egg that cracks open when the temperature becomes just right for it. A chicken egg that is fertilized and is watched over in the correct way will break open at whatever time the right temperature is reached. When it is time, the chick destroys the eggshell and comes out. That's the way it is. It overcomes the situation of being confined, constrained, and hindered. It pierces the thick shell, cracks the case, and comes out. So we too must undergo things that hold us back and free ourselves in a process that is self-evident. Eventually this will culminate in an experience of becoming one's own master. So seeing the practice in this way, we know, if all of us truly and sincerely keep up our efforts in the training, the practice, patipat, eventually there has to be liberation, patiwedhi. That is why the Buddha praised this training, conduct, and practice. It is because of this practice that the true Dhamma still exists as a counterpart to the world. If there wasn't this training, the true Dhamma could not remain established in the world. The same holds regarding ourselves. As long as there is this honesty and sincerity in us, the truth will eventually have to manifest. Without honesty and sincerity, there is no truth. This is why the Buddha praised making effort in practice. This applies to all of us. If this potential for perfection exists, we can't say we are not ready. All of us are ready. Each person, each monk, each and every one is well equipped, but we'll have to do the job of building things up by themselves. Look at your spiritual potential. Look at your faculties and observe uninterruptedly what you are experiencing. Is your awareness continuous? Does it follow up all the time? If not, don't try to force it. These things cannot be forced. In the story of Venerable Ananda, we can clearly see the problem that arises from forcing the practice, from grasping at one's goal. Ananda put forth a lot of effort in the practice, but was driven by forces of craving. This originated from the prediction made by the Buddha that he, too, would attain to arhantship. Venerable Ananda upheld this in his mind, and his desire overtook his practice. In everything he did in his practice, he was walking the path of one overcome by craving. He didn't practice using the power of awareness by putting things down, so a lot of obstacles overcame him until he was finally too physically weak and exhausted and thought of having a rest. The simple thought that now the body was too weak to practice caused him to abandon his craving and put down his efforts. When he was just about to lie down, his feelings changed. This enabled him to relax and let go of his clinging to the importance of all that he held on to. Eventually, he experienced the state of freedom. It all depended on him letting things be, on his putting down the feelings of grasping at his goal, which were driven by tanha, craving. Craving had been alongside him all the time. When he was able to let go of it, nothing was left. He experienced a state of purity, brightness, clarity, and freedom, which was complete in and of itself. Contemplating this story, even though it is a description from the textbooks, can serve as a simile, a parable for our own practice. So this is the way all of us should practice continuously. If we practice continuously, our practice will show signs of growth and development by itself. We can compare it to the work of maintaining and caretaking. We have a duty to maintain and to take care of the standards of our practice, kol wat, going about our routines in a continuous way so that it becomes sama patipada, complete practice. This will bring about certain qualities, including strength and energy. The experience will let one know for oneself that this is sama patipada. If we keep practicing in this way, there comes a day, there comes a time, where we too must eventually come to the point of liberation. If one keeps traveling, it is impossible not to arrive at one's destination. If we keep walking without stopping, this has to be the case. We simply need to set our aspirations towards freedom.